This is WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves from Henry Ford Community College. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek. Thank you for being with us today for local news and alternative views about Dearborn and the surrounding area. I'm joined in hosting the show by Dennis Reimars, our WHFR news reporter and also editor of the Mirror newspaper here at Henry Ford Community College. Good morning, Dennis.
Good afternoon, Jay.
Well, whatever. Depends on what time you got up, I guess, right?
Okay. I think you just told us something.
How was that farmer's market today?
It was awesome. It was a little brisk, but based on the weather and everything, I didn't expect as many people, and it was a lot of people out there.
Keeps the fresh vegetables fresh.
I think so.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, well, we have a special guest in the studio, too, with Dennis and myself today. A little bit different because it's an author. Now, as a talk show host, there's some sort of list nationally or multiple lists where I get a whole bunch of books free or book offers free. People do book tours and they try to push their books and so on. And usually I say no because it's not a local author, or it's not a topic of a special concern to us locally. But in this case, we struck gold in both counts. So we have with us today here in the studio Steve Lehto, that's L-E-H-T-O, and he's the author of several books. He lives in this area and works in this area too. So welcome to the WHFR Journal, Steve.
Welcome. It's good to be here.
Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background and how it is that you became an author. Certainly Dennis wants to know about that.
Absolutely.
He's trying to become an author. And good luck to that, Dennis.
wow.
But no, Steve, you have a distinguished career, and it's interesting that you're four books now?
Something like that. I've also written the forewords for other books, so it's hard to keep track. But
they sort of change topics. Two of them sort of relate in terms of topics. The first one was on Douglas Houghton. And people may not know that he was significant in the history of the state of Michigan.
Well, yeah, and then Douglas Houghton was the state geologist in 1837, and then in 1840 he wrote a report about the copper deposits in the Upper Peninsula, and his report's what actually started the copper boom up there. But along with that, he was the mayor of Detroit. He was a professor at the University of Michigan. He was on the expedition that found the headwaters of the Mississippi. He was a licensed physician. His resume is this long, and he died at the age of 36.
And they named a lake after him.
A lake, a county, all kinds of stuff. Yeah, he's the guy they named everything after.
Okay. Should be called the state of Houghton then, I guess.
Yeah.
I missed out on that one. And then your next book sort of relates to the fact that your own background or your own profession is that of being a lawyer, and it's called The Lemon Book.
Well, The Lemon Law Bible.
The Lemon Law Bible,
yeah.
Yes.
Actually, yeah, that was the first book I wrote, and that was the book.
Oh, I'm sorry. Got the dates wrong.
You're just looking at it in reverse order, that's all.
Okay, yeah.
But The Lemon Law Bible, and my specialty is I do consumer protection work, but it's primarily lemon law. So I represent people who've bought defective products, and surprisingly, a large number of them have bought defective cars.
Right. I think everybody probably knows the phrase lemon laws, or especially in this area, in referring to an automobile, a bad car, a car that breaks down a lot or is never working right in the first place. And a variety of states, but not every state in the U.S., they actually have laws that talk about how people can go about getting justice for themselves.
Well, now all 50 states do have lemon laws, but they are of varying degrees of usefulness, and some states are almost worthless. Florida, for instance, has a very bad lemon law.
Yeah.
Michigan's got a good one, though.
I should mention to our listeners that this book, at least from my brief search on Google and Amazon and so on, seems to be almost the definitive law book. It was written in, or published first in 2000. So you're kind of the expert. There's one other big title that apparently a gentleman wrote more specifically just for California lemon law.
Yeah.
So, boy, do we have the expert here. We'll talk to him later about what car is not a lemon these days? But no, we all want to know about that. But no, we brought you here primarily because of your most recent book, which is Chrysler's Turbine Car, which has gotten a lot of good press. And as you introduced to me today, it's mentioned significantly in a current edition of Vanity Fair magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Very prestigious and classy magazine, and also, was it the Free Press?
The Wall Street Journal got it. A full page on it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me summarize to my listeners that who may not realize that Chrysler actually did produce a car that was powered by a turbine engine. That's right, like a jet engine, like on those big planes that take off from Metro Airport, but a small-sized one. And it was remarkable. This was around 1964. I remember the date when they did this sort of introduction because my dad worked at Chrysler Corporation just on assembly line and Trenton engine plant. But we were very excited as a family, and so was the corporation. And you've documented the whole history of this, which is an amazing job of history. I guess you're sort of a history buff or a stickler for digging up things like the life of Douglas Houghton, too. But this is a real big background. Could you tell our listeners, and for Dennis, too, how did you happen to get into this topic, though? You just finished the book on Houghton?
Well, I grew up in southeastern Michigan, and I remember seeing these jet cars on the road when I was a very young child, and you couldn't miss them back then. There's a whole fleet of them that they put out there, and they were all the same color, as a bright copperish bronzish color, mm-hmm. and they sounded like jets. And I remember seeing them as a child, and then later on they kind of just disappeared, and wondering about it in later years. Whatever happened to those cars? And I was talking to a brother of mine, and my brother at the time, actually to this day, still works at Williams International in Walled Lake. And he said, well, you realize that a lot of the guys who worked on those cars now work over here making jet engines. And I realized that there would be a great source of interviews there for an oral history. So I interviewed a lot of guys who worked on the program to find out how the program worked, why they built the cars, how well the cars worked, and then, of course, what happened to the cars.
I have to say it's extremely readable. I mean, I've as a college professor, I've read histories about all kinds of things, which were extremely dull and pompous and stuffy, and maybe very important, but not good communication. So I commend you, that your writing is really can be read by everybody. Well, maybe a good high school education, so you know some words. We've sort of criticized the educational system in this country in the show last week like crazy with the movie being released. Waiting for Superman. Topic has obviously come up. Well, you got into this. We didn't mention the other book. You did a book previous to this about a sort of a mass murder in Michigan, 1913, and that's kind of the lead-in for how you made connections with Jay Leno, who is also significant in this story about how Chrysler's turbine car came to be. Tell us about that Leno connection.
Well, I wrote a book called Death's Door about the Italian Hall disaster, and that's where somebody ran into a crowded theater in 1913 and yelled fire just to cause a panic. And 73 people died trying to get out of this building in a stampede, and there was no fire. So I wrote a book about this, and of course, you know, it's a slice of Michigan history. It's a fascinating story, I think. And the book is called Death's Door, and it's got a very dark, depressing cover, okay? And somebody in the Upper Peninsula ran an advertisement for the book in a local newspaper where they said, Death's Door makes a great Christmas gift. And somebody cut out that article and mailed it to Jay Leno, and he ran it on his funny headlines segment one Monday evening.
Yeah.
And I started getting phone calls from all over the country from people who'd seen it. And so I took a copy of Death's Door and I gift wrapped it and I mailed it to Jay.
We should mention that that book was in this newspaper story as a great gift item because of your Finnish-American connection, right?
Yes, yes.
And it was actually a Finnish-American, if you will, paper up in Upper Peninsula that saw this as a great gift. Here's something that a Finnish American wrote that you can give to another Finnish American,
right?
It wasn't connected with the sort of gruesome deaths or the horrible deaths and Christmas at all. They just thought, here's a Finnish-American product, creative work that you could share with someone else valuing Finnish-American history. Just a little aside, since we had the time, your parents actually went to school up there. It was Hancock, Michigan, where
my family
was then called Suomi.
Suomi College.
Suomi.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now it's Finlandia University.
Right. My grandfather was the dean of Suomi College.
Wow. Okay.
And they renamed it Finlandia. And the joke is they did that so they could change all their logos to where they say FU.
Sure.
And my grandfather, trust me, is spinning in his grave right now that they've done that. But it's hard for non-Finns to say Suomi. So Finlandia is probably better marketing all the way around.
It was a Native American tribe or something.
Suomi. No. Suomi is the Finnish word for Finland.
Oh, it is a Finnish word.
Yeah, yeah. It's like Magyar for Hungary. Yeah.
So Finns talk about Finland as Suomi.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
See how much we learn on this show?
Well, that's all the time we have to. I'm just kidding.
We're talking to author Steve Lehto, that's Lehto, about his book Chrysler's Turbine Car. And this he can now go back and pardon this, finish the story about the Jay Leno connection.
Yeah, so I sent Jay a copy of Death's Door and I gift wrapped it. And I know that he's obviously not going to be that into a piece of Michigan history so much, but I know he's a car guy. And I had a manuscript for the Turbine Car book laying around and I couldn't get a publisher for it because it's a car book. And there's a big prejudice against car books in the publishing industry. Yeah, go to Borders and look for the car book section. It's usually a dark corner someplace and they've got like Chilton's and manuals and it's not that, you know, well kept up. So I sent him that manuscript and he called me. And my secretary says, "Hey, Steve, there's some guy on the phone says he's Jay Leno." And I knew it had to be him because I hadn't told anybody I'd done that. And he called me and he said, "Hey, you know, number one," he goes, "you're not mad at me, are you?" I said, "No." And he goes, "Oh, you'd be surprised. Some people get angry at us for making fun of them." But I said, no, I understood. It was just a joke. And the headline was funny, you know. So he goes, "Well, I love this book. I read this Turbine Car book. I love this book. I've always loved these cars. Why don't you get it published?" As if that was something I could just go out and do. And I said, "Well, I've been working on that, Jay, but so far nothing, you know." Yeah, and then later on, about 2 years later, he actually bought a Turbine Car. And he did that when he was in town doing those free shows out at the Palace.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me up again out of the blue and said, "Hey, Steve, I need to get a hold of a guy named Bill Carey that you interviewed for your book." Now, Bill Carey is the head mechanic on the program for these cars. And I said, "Jay, why would you need the number of a mechanic for a Turbine Car unless you had one? And there's only 9 of them left in the world."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, I can't tell you just yet." But it turns out he had just bought a Turbine Car. And so I got him and Bill Carey together. Make a long story short, he called me back to thank me and said, "If you're ever in California, I'll let you drive my Turbine Car." And I was in California so fast, it would blow your mind.
I can bet. I bet. And that's the last chapter in the book. Besides the fact that he did go ahead and write the foreword to the book for you, the last chapter is that visit that you do, sort of bringing the whole thing full cycle. And not only does he give you a ride in it, but he lets you drive it on the way back or something.
Yes, and that even I wasn't expecting that. We were in a parking lot taking pictures. A guy from Mopar Action Magazine came out with me to document all this. And I said, "Hey, Jay, you know, you did promise to let me drive it." And I thought he'd just, you know, say, "Oh, drive it in circles around the parking lot and just don't hit anything, you know." He's, "Oh, no, drive us back to the garage." And I'm like, "You're kidding me, in traffic?" He's like, "Sure." So,
yeah,
great
guy. He likes to drive his cars a little bit, not a lot, all of them, but they're all in working condition.
Yes.
He's got all kinds of mechanics, apparently, in his huge solar-powered air-conditioned garage where he keeps all his motorcycles out in the desert. It's all solar-powered. I think a couple of weeks ago I saw in the paper that he had broken that one of his cars broke down and there he was stalled in traffic. It was an old electric car.
No, it was a steam car.
Steam car.
And he gave me a ride in that car too.
Oh my gosh. Well, so but he's a great he actually writes other articles about automobiles too, and a great lover of automobiles of all kinds. And the Turbine, of course, didn't he buy an extra engine also?
Well, he's poking around looking for one, but the car he has runs fine.
Right.
He's got one of the few that runs.
Yeah. And this is after 40 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a Turbine Car, for instance, at the Detroit Historical Society. They've got one, and so does, like, Henry Ford.
Henry Ford Museum.
But theirs doesn't run, little-known fact. So Jay's got one that runs, and he drives it around, and, you can go onto YouTube and find footage of him driving it around, just taking it places and showing it to people.
Right. That's a credit to the ruggedness of the original design. I don't know too many internal combustion cars without major work or usually engine replacement. I remember in those days, engines were lucky. I mean, there was all sort of self-destructed, like 30,000 miles, and then there was sort of a I think they started putting some warranties in place, and the manufacturers somewhere around the 60s or 70s saying, well, we'll guarantee them up to 50,000.
Right.
And then
right.
they die at 55,000.
Yeah.
But most engines today will go internal combustion engines, 100,000, 150,000 before they need major repair or major
right,
work.
Right.
But the turbine engine, wow, what a fantastic concept. I do recommend to people, if you're going to Henry Ford Museum right here in Dearborn, look for Chrysler's turbine car. It's this beautiful gold color that they all were, and you can get within 3 feet of it. Unfortunately, the way it's turned around, you can't see the beautiful rear end of it, which is sort of spaceship-like, and it's a great design by Ghia. Italy?
Elwood Engel designed it. He was the designer who'd been at Ford during part of the T-Bird program, and then he came over to Chrysler, and it was hand-built in Italy by Ghia, and then shipped over here, and they put the drivetrains in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's amazing about it is, I know, even in 64, when I was graduating from high school, and I heard about a jet engine in a car, there's all that whishing noise and the hot gases coming out of the back that will burn and scald you. I mean, you just think about airports and, you know, the noise factor, and you don't want to be around the exhaust of a jet engine of an airliner, you know, at all, because that's very, very dangerous. But in fact, these were small turbines, and in fact, one of the people that was working this project had his own, developed his own company, too, that you know about, that you mentioned in here, to make small turbine engines for a variety of propulsion purposes. And I remember the ads too for this, that we can talk about the sound, but the exhaust was, you know, you could hold pieces of paper there, wouldn't burst into flame, and it was totally really sort of like clean. It was just water vapor coming out, really. There was no carbon monoxide pollution, and so it was actually a fantastic adaptation of a jet engine.
Well, and you have to think about this, that they spent 25 years developing this.
Yeah,
and they didn't,
I mean, realize the background. Yeah, even in the 40s, Chrysler got into thinking about it.
Yeah, and it was a huge, huge department within Chrysler. And Chrysler, you know, all of the car companies had played around with turbines. Ford did, GM did. But Chrysler had a department devoted to turbines. And they solved many of the problems that people had thought were unsolvable. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, with the issue of the heat coming out the tailpipe, they actually ran the exhaust through a thing called a regenerator. And it salvaged some of the heat. And instead of going out the tailpipe, they brought the heat back around and put it back into the combustion chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were actually recycling the heat. A very, very strange concept. And if you look at the turbine engine, it does not look like anything you'd see in a jet.
Right.
But that's because they had taken all these problems that people thought could never be fixed, and they figured them out.
So you said strange, but I mean very efficient.
Yes.
So without ruining, why did it, it's no longer around?
It's no longer around because
he wants to get to the punchline.
Yeah, well, that's me. I'm impatient.
No, but that's people. People say, you know, they hear me talk about how wonderful his car was. And they go, well, then where are they?
Exactly.
You know?
If it runs on tequila, for gosh sakes.
Yeah, Chanel No. 5 and vegetable oil. Yeah.
Do we really? That's more expensive than
that's
petroleum
true.
Based.
That's true. but the key really was three things happened at the same time. The government started cracking down on tailpipe emissions because of the problem of smog. Remember back in the 70s, smog popped into the popular imagination. And so they started cracking on tailpipe emissions, and the turbine engineers had been working so hard on making this thing efficient and bulletproof that they hadn't been working on the tailpipe emissions as much as they needed to. And they didn't see it coming. Nobody did. Along that same time, the first OPEC oil embargo and the price of gasoline went through the roof. And when these turbine cars were originally on the road, gasoline was 25 cents a gallon. So when people said, oh, by the way, this thing can burn all kinds of other fuels, people said, who cares? Well, what happened was, with the oil embargo, the federal government came in and cracked down on CAFE standards and said, we want all cars to get so many miles per gallon. And again, they'd been making the vehicles more bulletproof and more reliable, but they hadn't been working on fuel economy. And while they were trying to figure those two things out, Chrysler ran into their first financial troubles. And that's right when they almost went bankrupt, right before Lee Iacocca bailed them out. And that time frame, they actually had to make the decision, are we going to tool up to mass produce these cars or not? They'd made enough of them to prove it could be done, but they had not been in a position to mass produce them yet.
Right.
And they didn't have the money to build the factories.
There's so many interesting corollary stories here, like, and we don't want to get too libertarian about this, but the government standards initially were just sort of crazy quilt. I mean, just... almost out of nowhere. And I'm not saying there shouldn't be government standards, but they were really surprised, in fact, of the inconsistencies of it. And as you said, just marketing timing, their own cars were extremely unreliable and falling apart, and there was quality control issues. And although when I was growing up, my dad always said Chrysler's got the best engines. And this was like late 50s, 60s. They had a slant six for a while that was known good. And the Chryslers we had weren't that terrible in terms of quality control, at least compared to other cars on the road at the time. So the turbine car, I think, would have been viable. And in fact, after 40 years, it could have been, you can only assume that there wouldn't be a ceiling to the improvements, that the technology could have been with us for quite a while. I personally think that maybe electric cars are going to be the vision of the future for a number of reasons, but this could have been, I mean, we mentioned the fuels, and certainly Chanel No. 5 cost a little expensive there with $120 an ounce or maybe more. But this ran also on diesel fuel. It wasn't a diesel engine, but diesel fuel, especially then, was even cheaper.
But it ran on alcohol. It ran on peanut oil. I mean, there's all kinds of different things. And all you need to have is one or two alternatives. You don't need to have 15 alternatives.
Right.
And anything that was non-petroleum based is suddenly very interesting when you realize that, you know, right now we're beholden to countries that have oil under their sand, you know, and it makes you wonder. I really think that the real net product of this program, because people say, well, it's kind of sad it went away. Well, if you think about the technology that came from the program, though, the guys who left and went and founded Williams International and Walled Lake, for instance, who make small jet engines, that's probably the perfect use for this would be to put a turbine engine in the trunk of a car that has an electric motor and use the turbine engine to recharge the batteries. And that's experiments. They tried that with the EV1 electric car. They actually, Williams did build prototypes of that, and they got them to work. They'd have to mass produce them to bring down the cost, but it would certainly make more sense than putting a piston engine in the trunk of a car like they're doing with the Volt.
Yeah, the turbine engine, of course, had a couple of scary elements. If you knew, first of all, the temperature of the combustion was something like, 2,000 degrees inside?
Yeah.
And that scared some people because that's hot. And the tachometer in the turbine cars in 64, 65 that people drove, I don't know if it had miles per hour on it, but it had RPM. And the RPM, the engines were comfortable spinning their blades at 40,000 RPM. I think the limit on the device was 60,000.
Yeah, the tach right up to 60,000, and the red line is 44,000.
Yeah, and people are like, whoa, and those blades fly off. And, of course, some of them did over the 40 years of testing that Chrysler had, but they finally, with hand care, they made engines that were really rugged and reliable. They didn't have kind of danger or threat. And, in fact, if anybody really wants to research the internal combustion engine, the stuff going on under your hood today, it's not exactly safe either. I mean, there's flame and there's heat and there's highly complicated these days with all the emission control equipment and extra add-ons. And I mentioned on this show, I've been looking for 6 months for a new car. I finally decided to buy a diesel, which I haven't taken delivery on yet. But even the contemporary diesel, oh my gosh, they've got all kinds of add-ons because of noise, vibration, bad smell that the old diesels used to have, like the old big trucks of the 40s and 50s. And now they're fine. And in Europe, they're using a lot of small diesels, and they're getting 60, 70 miles to a gallon with these things, and they got real spunk around town anyway in terms of acceleration. And they're clean. They're relatively clean. And we'll be getting more of those over here probably in a couple of years. But my point is, they're not simple either. Gosh, the technology and all the circuits to adjust and regulate, you know, computer control stuff. If they just would have had like the computer controls and the like robot manufacturing techniques then, this could have happened. It's just one of those crazy twists and turns of fate that the best technology, the most innovative ideas that really could have helped us the longest. I know hindsight is always better than foresight. It just didn't happen. I have the other book here, the only book out, and it's hardly available anymore, about General Motors electric vehicle test back in the 90s, The Car That Could, by Michael Shanerson. And that is another story. It sounded almost like the Chrysler thing. They made a number of cars, like 50 did they make, or 100 of those EV ones, and like Chrysler made 50, and then for a year or so they had people testing them all around the country. Right. Great success. Everybody loved them pretty much, some minor little mechanical things.
Right.
And then they end it, and for a variety of reasons, including certainly not pollution issue, but the public wouldn't buy something that strange. Even though the test was a total success, they just you know, gave up on it and trashed them all, too, similar to the way Chrysler trashed most of the turbines.
That's
Dennis had a final question.
Well, that's why I get all my technology from the Amish. But my question, a lot of research went into this. How long did it take to put all this together and the interviews and the writing?
On and off, about a year or so.
Oh,
maybe
not
a little more.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I'll tell you right now, this is with a new publisher, with Chicago Review Press.
Okay.
And I gave them what I thought was a finished manuscript, and they marked it up and gave it back to me. I realized that I had more work to do.
Yeah.
And went through that process a few times. So there was a lot of work after I was, quote unquote, done writing it. But
they
yeah.
made it a lot better product, too.
Oh, absolutely. They could tell me to do anything. I would have done it because it turned out much, much better.
Excellent. Yeah.
Editors yeah. actually do have a very important purpose, and not just for marketing purposes, but I think every good writer loves having a good editor.
And we're all aiming for the same thing, which is to have
exactly.
a good, readable product.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. So congratulations on making this. Highly recommend this book to you folks. We don't usually recommend books or endorse them. But Chrysler's Turbine Car by Steve Lehto, L-E-H-T-O. It's gotten really good reviews, a lot of places, including, as we just mentioned earlier, Wall Street Journal recently, and Vanity Fair magazine has an article. It's definitely one of those important bits of history so that we're not doomed to repeat it. If there's great technology, great innovation happening, we need to try to go forward. We need to try to make it happen as a society, and especially the issue of personal transportation is a vital concern to all of us. So two last things here, Steve. One is the sound of the turbine car. When you rode in it, how can you describe the sound of the engine?
It sounded just like when you're in a jet at Metro Airport and you're taxiing around the runway. That whining sound that you hear, it sounded just like that.
But not quite as loud. You didn't have to wear headphones.
No. And
earplugs.
You know, yeah, but trust me, if one of these things drove by you, it would get your attention.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a very distinctive whooshing sound. It's like a vacuum cleaner on steroids.
I had... in the early 80s, when I was going through my first midlife crisis, a Mazda RX-7, which had a rotary engine, a Wankel.
Yeah, the Wankel,
and, yeah. And developed in Germany, but then Mazda has developed it further since then. Still on the road in an RX-8, I don't know for how much longer. But the point is, that had almost a turbine-like acceleration because there's no pistons going up and down fighting that spinning. It just kept spinning. It's just whoosh, you know.
Yeah.
And even if it was a manual transmission in the Wankel cars, and some of them had automatics, but the point was the acceleration was just sort of smooth and constant. And the turbine car, I never heard one myself. I wish somebody would just record that sound so I could download it.
Or you can go visit Mr. Leno.
Oh, I'm sure. Does he give tours? No, not usually. But what a wonderful story. And so thank you on behalf of Detroit and the history of Detroit. Thank you for doing this. But I think there's so many things that connects to the next decisions we have to make about the kinds of cars we buy individually, as well as help support the development of. Again, stuff about government rules and regulations, about big business and the kind of ethical or stupid decisions they make about things. I mean, a lot of important stuff to take notes on here and to think about and to try to get the right direction to go ahead. Last question for you, and thank you for being here on the Journal today, talking about this book, again, Chrysler's Turbine Car, Steve Lehto. Your legal profession, you've dealt with lemon laws. How's that going these days? Are there many lemons as there used to be? In other words, really bad cars that people need to get some sort of support for? I mean,
yeah.
How many Toyota owners have you
interestingly enough,
helped out in the last year?
None.
Okay.
The main thing is that most lemons are not created by the manufacturer. They're usually created by bad service.
Mm.
So that I used to get calls regarding certain types of vehicles, and I'd think, well, maybe this is a bad car. And I realized that, no, most of the calls I get were coming from people who had their vehicles serviced at certain dealerships.
Uh-huh.
Because the law says if it's defective and can't be repaired after 4 repair attempts, then the manufacturer's got to buy it back. Well, if the dealership can't fix it, it's usually because they're incompetent. It's not because the vehicle's badly manufactured. And it's amazing how often that's the case.
Even with the level, the degree of technology, the complexity of the cars that we have today, I mean, some things are just very hard to locate what the problem is. You know,
well, partly some of the car companies did cut back on how much money they'd spend on warranty repairs in terms of diagnosing a problem.
So
if you bring your car into a dealership and say it hesitates, they'll give a technician 15 minutes to look at that car and determine what he thinks is wrong with it. And I know technicians say, I might take a day to figure that out. No, you get 15 minutes.
Right.
So a good dealership will say, you know, something, we'll take the first 15 if you can't fix it. Then we'll, you know, look for it on our time. Other dealerships, no, we're so busy, 15 minutes, fix whatever you can, move on. And so I think most of them are caused by bad service, not the manufacturers.
And some of the things, some of the problems, you can't diagnose them from just attaching a computer.
Right.
Like little noises, little rattles. You can't find out where they are unless it's going a certain speed over a certain kind of road. I had a car like that a couple of years ago. And Consumer Reports said it was not one you should buy, and you know, very unreliable. And so I bought it anyway.
What the heck? Yeah. Run with scissors.
Yeah. But what do you think about this question about patriotism and you should buy an American-made car? Just to put you on the real hot seat here, is there clearly a car made in America, foreign or U.S., that is higher in quality, do you think?
You know, I don't know about that because there's no bright line on any of this. You know, you can find cars built in Canada that are sold here, cars built in Ohio that are, you know, Japanese technically in badge. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think right now General Motors is building plants in China faster than they're building cars in America.
Yes.
You know, and so the question is, at what point does something become American? I drive a Ford, you know.
Okay.
But on the other
hand. Good to say in Dearborn, our mayor loves you.
But it's, I'll tell you, I got a Ford Explorer right now. It's got 233,000 miles on it with the original serpentine belt. Okay,
I want to. Is that with the original tires? Is this one of those cars that had the recall on the tires?
I change tires every 100,000 miles. I'd like to find the people who are in charge of Explorers and go shake their hands. Those guys build a mighty fine car.
Well, that's awesome. I'm glad you feel that way. The new Explorer is quite a bit different in design, but also has good reviews.
Okay, good.
So,
I'm going to need one pretty soon.
There's the new Eco 4 engine, which may be a little underpowered for the big car, but it's based on the. That wagon thing, the real boxy wagon. It's on the same chassis now.
Okay.
As that Flex.
Yeah.
I don't like a car that's called a Flex. I don't want a car to flex. But
I don't think those cars flex either. doesn't look like Flex.
But the new Eco 4, which will come out next spring in the Explorer, that's my recommendation. So see you, Steve.
Okay.
You gave us something, we gave you something.
There you go.
This is Steve Lehto, Lehto, his new book, Chrysler's Turbine Car. Thanks for being with us today on the Journal and helping to keep Michigan history, and in this case, particularly automotive history, alive because it is oh so relevant now. Thanks so much for being with us. We're going to just go to Jim Hightower, our commentator, and we'll be back with more Journal and local news and views in just 4 minutes. Stay tuned.
Recently, I found myself humming the old Beatles song, Poppy Feels Forever. Okay, John Lennon's lyric was not about poppies, but strawberries. However, I started humming the song because I was thinking about our country's multi-trillion-dollar mission to build a viable central government and a new economy in Afghanistan. The White House and Pentagon tell us that one of the keys to success in this massive nation-building effort is to wean impoverished Afghan farmers from dependence on their only reliable money-making crop, poppies. Yes, opium poppies. Afghanistan is by far the world's number one producer of this drug crop, which is bought by traffickers who move it from remote Afghan villages to our streets some 7,000 miles away. Not only are our troops defending a country that routinely fuels America's narcotics problem, but the Taliban forces that are killing and maiming our soldiers are largely financed by payments they extract from these opium traffickers. Thus, it was good news when our officials proudly and loudly announced in September that poppy cultivation in Helmand Province dropped 7% this year, thanks to hundreds of millions of dollars we've spent to persuade farmers there to switch from poppies to veggies. But don't get too high on this progress. Nationwide, this year's production was as high as ever. Indeed, it increased by a third in Kandahar, a key province ruled by the Afghan president's own brother, who is said to be getting a piece of the action. Also, 2011 looks worse, for poppy prices have nearly tripled this year, enticing more farmers to abandon lower-paying alternative crops and return to planting the old standby. This is Jim Hightower saying, poppy fields truly might be forever. And that's yet another reason to get our troops out of there. Pronto.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Are you aware that America has now been at war for nearly a decade? We've been fighting, bleeding, and dying in two hellacious multi-trillion dollar conflagrations since 2001, and our blood continues to flow with no end in sight. Well, not our blood. Not yours and mine. We continue to go about our daily routines. Go to work, go to the mall, go out to eat, go golfing, go to church, go on vacation, go dancing and drinking. War? Americans will pay far more attention to the World Series than they will to the ongoing carnage in Afghanistan and Iraq. In a little-noted speech, Pentagon Chief Robert Gates recently pointed out that, quote, for most Americans, the war remains an abstraction, a distant and unpleasant series of news items that do not affect them personally. Service in the military, he bluntly says, has become something for other people to do. He's right. You see, we are not at war. We handed off that awful duty a decade ago to the 2.4 million active and reserve soldiers in the armed services, less than 1% of our nation's people. They and their families are the ones at war, cycled and recycled into debilitating and deadly deployments. We, the people, are not even making the minimal sacrifice of paying for the burden we've so carelessly stacked on their shoulders. Both the Bush regime and the Obamacans, fully backed by both Republican and Democratic Congresses of the past decade, cravenly put Afghanistan and Iraq on the national credit card, piling up trillions of dollars in debt for future generations to cover. This is Jim Hightower saying, the widening disconnect between Americans and America's wars is not only dangerous for our democracy, but it's immoral. It allows politicians and corporate profiteers to sink our national soul in the diabolical depths of perpetual war.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
This is the new WHFR Journal for Friday, October the 15th, 2010. Jay Kornick with you and Dennis Reimars in the studio. We did just have a call while Jim Hightower was talking to you, our loyal listeners, from someone that actually was there. I'm sure a lot of people, if they were listening to the show in this area and were around back in 64, 65, he was there for the crushing of the cars, of these beautiful golden Chrysler turbines. About 40 some were crushed, I think, at that point.
Wow.
I said I would have been crying, and he said he was, too. So it's so sad to see great technology and great innovative ideas, a lot of hard work of people. I should mention, too, is that Chrysler's public relations is documented throughout the 15 years. They had their first turbine car they showed to the public that drove back in the early 50s, just in a regular bodied Plymouth, and then all. It's beautiful. It's a textbook for how to do good corporate public relations. Slow, careful, not lying,
right,
not exaggerating, but just moving ahead in with a great advertising plan. Really, none of their promotions for the final release of these cars were badly designed or failed. I think only like once in like 25 years, one of the cars that they had for demonstration wouldn't start. But basically, it was like hundreds of thousands of miles and so many wonderful events, very positive. It just then everything fell apart at Chrysler in terms of quality control, and this separate division just sort of was taken apart too by Chrysler.
Thought of more as a luxury, wasn't it?
Yeah.
As opposed to the future.
Yeah. Okay. Here's a couple follow-ups on the journal here. We have couple things to mention. One is Scotty Bowman was here on the show, and he's running for Secretary of State on the Libertarian Party ticket this November 2nd. And I don't know how many other Secretary of States you might have noticed. There was a debate that was on WKAR, and it's still, you can go and look at it, kar.org, that's the MSU station, Tim Skupik, the host. For a half an hour, he had Ruth Johnson and Jocelyn Benson. That's the Republican and the Democrat, Ruth Johnson, the Republican, and Jocelyn Benson, the Democrat, for Secretary of State. So when have you ever had a chance to hear a debate for 30 minutes between Secretary of State candidates? So if you just add Scotty Bowman's comments here from our show toss in there the comments of these two folks, you get a very interesting picture of how this very, very important office needs to be run. And in fact, I did see this debate. I want to tell you that I was so impressed with Jocelyn Benson.
Really?
This is a Democratic woman. She is a law professor at Wayne State University. I love intelligent people, especially when they show their intelligence. And trust me here, this sounds crazy, but she wrote the book on Secretary of States. What? Yeah, she wrote a definitive book. It just came out this year. It cost $90 or $71 for the Kindle edition.
Right.
On the history and the effectiveness of Secretary of States across the whole country, throughout the United States of America. She is the de facto, because there's nobody else that's written such a book, expert. Legal expert on Secretary of State's offices and how important they are and how they've affected elections and, of course, licensing for a variety of things. And what an ideal candidate. Again, can a professor be an administrator? But what an ideal candidate. Ruth Johnson, the Republican, is not any more administrator either. But Jocelyn Benson was very impressive to me. I'm not saying I'm going to vote for her, nor do I recommend you do, but if you want to listen to our Scotty Bowman piece, which ran, I know Dennis has it on the tip of his tongue,
September
the 17th.
I think it was the 17th.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So if you go to whfr.fm and you go to the journal button for our archived podcast, you click on September, that is the 9th month, 17th day, Scotty Bowman talks for about 20 minutes, half an hour, on what he would do as an officer at the Secretary of State's level. Add that to the WKAR.org archive of the Tim Skupik show, where he interviews Ruth Johnson, Republican, and Jocelyn Benson, Democrat. And again, highly recommend you look at the credentials. I've very rarely seen someone who has such amazing scholarly credentials and who speaks so well too. Do I think she won the debate? Okay, she did. There's no doubt about it. She
right.
knew everything there is to know because she's sort of the expert on it, and she's got plans and she's got guidelines. This is not just a political office, you know, folks, the Secretary of State. They really have to do stuff. Sort of like the Attorney General has to do things, but often the choice of their cases is somewhat influenced by their political philosophies,
sure.
I think. But Secretary of State, that's just, you know, doing the best for everybody, and I think it can be a little bit more pragmatic and a little bit, you know, if you know how to organize, get things done. So Jocelyn Benson knows the history. We just talked to Steve Lado. He knows the history of Chrysler Turbine Car anyway, and she knows the history of Secretary of State's.
And you're thinking that could possibly translate.
Gotta mean something if you had to choose a candidate.
Right.
Now, we don't want to not mention that there is also a Green Party candidate running for Secretary of State. His name is John Anthony LaPietra. LaPietra. P-I-E-T-R-A. Green Party.
Okay.
What does he stand for? Don't know. Although he and Scotty had this press release that I'm holding in my hands, and they agree. Oh, that doesn't seem right. But the Green Party candidate and the Libertarian candidate, Scotty Bowman and LaPietra, seem to. So which one do we vote for?
Yeah, but you know, at the same time, you just said it, this would have less reason to follow along party lines. I mean, it's less of a party philosophy as opposed to let's just help everybody.
Yeah, philosophy affects. For example, they want to reject the Real ID Act. That is where everybody has to have a national ID,
right?
Coming from the federal government.
Scotty Bowman was very adamant about that,
right? And I don't see the need for it either. I've always been suspicious of of the French, even though their whole country is no bigger than Michigan.
Right.
I like the French a lot. I speak French pretty fluently, and I've been in France many times, but I see real problems with national ID cards. I know some of the people that hate the idea of an immigrant taking a step in our country at all is, you know, they want them. We've got to tell the difference between, you know, people who are supposed to be here and people that shouldn't be here. That's when we really get in trouble, folks, and we start making those designations. It's all kinds of reasons that are totally positive for people to come here and to take up residence here in the United States, and vice versa. All kinds of reasons why many of us probably should go to foreign countries and take up residence. Good for our business, good for our families, all kinds of reasons that we should have that mobility in the world. And I don't know. But it's just interesting that they do have this press release here. And they both did contact Jocelyn Benson and Ruth Johnson. And they didn't want them involved in this debate.
Hmm.
So they wouldn't appear on Tim Skupik's show with minority candidates.
Interesting.
That's not good. That's not, because they're totally, you know, above board choices. That's Scotty Bowman, B-O-M-A-N, I think it's .com, or votebowman.com or something like that. You can go through the Michigan Libertarian Party website to find out about him. And Green Party USA or Green Party of Michigan, you can Google that and find out about their candidates that way.
But right.
This is the latest twist and turn from Scotty Bowman, though. He is also running for another office.
Really?
In November. Yes. He discovered that in Detroit, there was no person on the ballot for the 7th District for the Detroit School Board. You know, now they're electing people from districts.
Okay.
Not at large across the whole city. Like we would pick the city council in Dearborn.
Sure.
We just pick, you know, the top candidates from the whole city, east and west.
Right.
There's no just East Dearborn candidate or whatever, or West Dearborn. So, but in Detroit now, they're trying for more accountability to go with individual districts that represent those neighborhoods more.
Okay.
Well, he discovered that the 7th District has no candidate.
Well, of course, he's a Detroit resident, too.
He's a Detroit resident. He's probably right in his area where he lives.
Sure.
And so he's starting a write-in campaign. He's trying to raise some money to have people know of him being available. And for some reason, this is crazy, he gives an example here in the email he sent me. The name Scotty is not able to be written in. They have to write Scott with two T's, Bowman, B-O-M-A-N.
I wonder why.
Maybe that's his legal given name.
Okay.
You know, he's always been called Scotty, but maybe that's what, yeah, I don't know why you couldn't.
Right.
For example, our famous jazz band director here, Rick Goward, legally his name is Ricky.
Really?
That's what his parents put down. So maybe if he runs for office, he's got to be Ricky yeah. Goward.
I can only open bank accounts with the name Lefty.
Yeah, well, sure. Or put all your money in the bag.
Yeah.
That's right. That's a famous write-in, too. Okay, local. So he's just to let you know, he's, and I guess it's legal, you can vote in, you can run in more than one of office at the same time. One's local and one state. I guess maybe you have to take a choice. Or obviously, the public schools, folks, this is a part-time job.
Right.
So it's not like it's full-time, like you have two full-time jobs.
This isn't like he's hedging his bet. I mean, one, like you said, one Secretary of State's of really a much bigger prominence. You know,
well, of
I mean,
course, and I think he would do that job happily if he gets elected.
Sure.
But he could still do this other job because it's probably just a couple nights a week
right.
that he has to go to meetings. But very important, of course, to get good people in Detroit Public Schools. Who knows? You know, Robert Bob has said they got a $330 million deficit. He's
right.
trying to get the state of Michigan, it's been in all the papers this week and on TV, to just forgive that. Forgive the whole $330 million so they can start even.
Yeah.
Wow.
Let's see how that works out.
Tough. Yeah. Let's see if he's in that job for longer, too.
I'll tell you, Bowman's ambitious. We sensed that when
Scott
he was
Bowman?
Here.
Scott Bowman? Yeah. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But he needs to get the message out, little tags, little notes to people that he is available. He wants to run. Will you write his name in? But that's the 7th District, the 7th District School District in Detroit. I don't know what the area is, but again, you could find out more. Oh, so he's got another website. It's district7writein.scottybowman.org.
Okay.
So I think he just added to his other. That's District 7, the number 7, right in, straight through. District 7, the number 7, right in dot scottybowman.org. Just okay. Interesting twist and turn on that. Okay, what else is happening in Dearborn and the surrounding area? We've got about 12 minutes remaining in our show about local news and alternative views. Okay, in my little handy-dandy list here.
Quite a list there.
Well, I have to make a comment, Dennis, and maybe you appreciate this as a newspaper editor yourself. I've been very unhappy, and this, so I'm chiding the Dearborn Times-Herald and the Dearborn Press and Guide, especially the Press and Guide.
Right.
Mostly crime stories. That's the headlines. That's the front page now. It's hard to find any substantive investigative report about anything but a crime story now. And they just take that off the police blotter and then expand it a little.
Right.
It's very easy to do, folks. Maybe they do call up a victim or something and add to it. They've got their one or two remaining full-time writers. And I think it's because they don't have a lot of money to have people to dig up things and to investigate things or even attend all the city council meetings or all the Dearborn school board meetings, although maybe they do that. But apparently they don't think there's anything else happening because all we're getting is crime news.
Or in the case of the story about Ford Motor Company and the tax dollars, maybe they're just sending
hasn't appeared
out,
yet.
Maybe they're just waiting for
except that, yeah, God bless the Dearborn Times-Herald for putting the story in.
Yep.
3 weeks ago about Ford not paying their previous amount for taxes and technically being in default on their property taxes, not just in Dearborn, but throughout Michigan and the communities where they own property. That we assume they're still negotiating behind the scenes, and I hope Ford has started to negotiate with all these cities. Dearborn, again, should take the lead. And we have seen nothing in the press guide at all about this story. And it's true, it's happening, folks. And no follow-up from the Times-Herald.
Nope.
And I want to know as a citizen. I want to know. And I'm boycotting Ford cars. In fact, I already bought my new car because my self-imposed boycott, was in place until they do the right thing and talk to the city of Dearborn and work out to try to help the city through these difficult times, even if it's totally just and fair that they deserve a reduction in their assessment. Even if that is totally just and fair and holds up in court, if the city of Dearborn protests it, I mentioned 2 weeks ago, city of Wayne is not protesting it at all. They're just thinking about cutting major chunks out of their budget, like for the police and fire department.
Right, right.
Disbanding the whole police and fire department and maybe jobbing it out to some...
Pontiac just did that, by the way. They're using the Oakland County...
Not necessarily because of Ford.
No, not necessarily, but I'm just saying, but that's that we can watch that.
It's a choice for all of them.
Exactly.
If they have to, I know. Jack Lessenberry this week writes his column about Virge Bonaro and Snyder. He admits, and the Detroit News just stated yesterday, that they're endorsing Snyder for governor.
Okay.
But that's to be expected. The news, I think, forever has endorsed the Republican for governor. So don't think that's a very objective decision, folks. Okay.
Right.
Free Press, owned by the same people, I don't think they've endorsed anybody yet.
No.
Typically, the Free Press, before they were the same company as the news, they would always go with the Democrats.
Sure.
For whatever reason. What about all those minority parties, candidates? Oh, well. Snyder says, Lessenberry says, and I'll sum it up for you, but you should read it in the Metro Times. Although online, if you click on it, it says Bernero versus Snyder. As of yesterday, it has the right heading, but it has his editorial from last week, which has nothing to do.
No, but still a good read. Please, that's the one about the Constitution?
No, it's about the fact that the legislature voted the new budget based on federal money coming in this year, and we're going to be screwed next year.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They didn't decide any new taxes. They didn't decide any cuts. Everything is based on this new money that came in, and that's why in the debates between Snyder Bonaro a week ago, I said, how are you going to make up $1.6 billion in debt you're going to have next year when you won't have any federal money? The odds of federal money, even if Democrats get in nationally in the second, I doubt the Democrats will be brave enough to, you know, more taxes, more stimulus, even though they probably should. And the Republicans are certainly not going to do it if they get power. You know, it's going to be very difficult times, who's ever governor. So what did Lessenberry do? He does think Bonaro's the better candidate. He does think Snyder's going to win, though. However, he thinks the situation is exactly the same as when in 1948 Harry Truman beat John Dewey for president of the U.S. All the studies, all the support, all the surveys show Dewey's going to win by a landslide.
Right.
And they were all wrong. Is that after people voted Truman won. One of the reasons for that, too, is interesting, is that nobody liked Dewey as a person.
Right.
They didn't like him. Okay. He wasn't a friendly guy. He wasn't very personable. And also, Truman was the underdog.
Yeah, but I don't think you can say that in this case. I think Schneider is very well liked.
He seems like an amiable guy.
Yes.
That's the best I can say about
seems.
Him.
I like that.
Oh. Well, he hasn't gone into details. When he says, I'm going to reform the Michigan business tax, I'm going to have it a flat 6%. Excuse me, that's no change for the businesses, although apparently if you're small enough, you won't have to pay hardly anything
right.
under his new plan. But right now they're only paying 4.9%, 4.95% for a business tax, plus a bunch of little add-on percentages that probably come to more than 6%. But not much more. So he says, oh, it's going to cause everybody to flock to Michigan. I don't think so. Because it just makes it a little easier for the somewhat smaller businesses to compute the tax.
Okay.
But in fact, right now it's 4.95, and he's going to make it 6 for everybody and take out all those weird little extra calculations and allow some people at the lower levels, at the small business levels, to pay almost nothing. And I don't know when that kicks in. I read his 10-point plan. It's still so general, you don't know what the heck he's really going to do. Bernardo at least admits up front that he doesn't know exactly until he gets in office, and then he'll do the best.
And
make the best decisions he can.
And have you've said you've had your own experiences. A county commissioner, what's his name? I'm sorry.
Gary Warnchuk,
right. Did you mm-hmm. not say that he said that his first time in office, it took him a little bit of time to actually get used to what was going on and figure out what he was doing? I don't remember what the exact amount of time
right.
was.
All 3 terms, 6 years, he said, at the end of his 6 years in legislature. Now I finally get the idea how to introduce a bill and how to get it through and how to work. The biggest criticism, and Lessenberry focuses on this, is
right.
that Snyder has never been in government. And he's always not a career politician. But it takes a while to learn. And Snyder, remember, Bernardo was serving in the legislature.
Sure.
Maybe it was not an auspicious career there. But he knows how bills are introduced. He knows how lobbyists play their game. And he knows how to get compromise to get bills passed.
Right.
Jennifer Granholm even mentions now she was unprepared for that. She was attorney general. She was smart, but didn't know how to negotiate and get a bill passed.
Doesn't that make sense that there would be that learning curve?
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. And Bernardo has been that kind of politician. He knows how to do it, theoretically.
Yeah. Well, and that may be a case then where, I don't know, if Schneider turns out to be the better man or the one that's elected, we'll have to put up with that. That we'll have to, not put up with, but we'll have to be calm or be patient during that learning curve. I mean, in the end, it could be a better deal. You know, it's hard to tell.
Well, the problem is we need a lot of big answers quick because of the huge deficit.
Absolutely. There's so much more wrong than right.
And all of our legislators, and I'll blame the ones from Dearborn, too, that, well, we'll let the next governor figure out what to do. You know, you're up there. Figure out an answer now so that everybody's not quite collectively so messed up. And I cleaned up that word I was
going
to say.
Yes, you did.
Messed up next year and the year after that. We need answers for the state economy now. And I agree that Bernardo says we're all going to have to, suffer some, tighten our belts collectively. I think the rich, yes, as well as the poor, not to the extent they have any money to or any belt loops left to tighten any further. And there's going to have to be some sort of taxation increases in some places in some ways. I have to mention we have only 3 minutes now before Highway 61 gets started today from 2 to 6 p.m. with Joanne Korchinska, the best in blues. Oh, boy. There's someone by the name of Rocky something or other who is running against Gary Peters.
Rockowitz.
Rocky Rockowitz?
I believe that's...
Nickname is Rocky?
I believe so.
Okay. Running against Gary Peters. Peters is the Democrat. He's in Congress now from, like, is it Oakland County seat or somewhere in northern Detroit suburbs. And Rocky is being criticized by Peters, the Democrat, or one of the campaign committees that... You know, who knows who it is? Not necessarily that of Gary Peters. You know, I think it has to go through the candidate so we know it's the candidate's opinion or not. But this is one of the worst attack ads because it says, Rockowitz. Is in favor of a 23% sales tax on everybody nationwide. Does that sound familiar, Dennis?
Yes, it does.
It's the fair tax, folks. Right. That is so unjust to say that. That's merely going to replace all the withholding, sometimes 30% of your salary, that you get taken out of your check now. Doesn't talk about the rebate checks that are going to be part of that plan coming back to everybody who's making less than $40,000 every month. And it's going to do away with having to compute an income tax once a year. Do you love doing income tax once a year? Do you love that anguish and that suffering and all the receipts that you have to have? Do you love all the special favors that are in place, 67,000 pages of federal tax code and exemptions and exceptions that this person and that person has got, but probably not you or me? I don't. Find out what the national fair tax proposal is. Don't blame Rocky for that one. He's right about that, folks. But it won't cost you any more. Oh, 23% tax on my new car. 23% tax on my next house. You can't even afford a next house or a new car yet, folks. Don't worry about that. It works out as being extremely fair for everybody. Less hassle, more efficient for government. Does away with the IRS.
How much money that'll free up.
And a bunch of Democrats ought to be involved in that, too. Although right now in the state of Michigan, it was only Pete Hoekstra that was for it, and he didn't get the nomination for governor. Not that he should have, but I'm just saying that he was aware of what's good about that. So there's the Michigan fair tax, which would really help business if the Michigan income tax was a fair tax, too. It would raise our sales tax from 6 to 9.5%. And then do away with all the withholding and start rebate checks and come on. But there is so much dirty, slanted campaigning on TV. I'd say if I got to recommend anything, folks, for political, don't believe a single one of those ads and not these flyers either. We're going to have Suzanne Zarini on next week to talk to her about her Republican race for 15th District. Rep to Michigan and see what she has to say about this or that. But I can't recommend any candidates, not Bonaro, Snyder, Cerini, Durrani, even Durrani not so bad, in terms of their campaign ads.
No.
Unfair attack ads, slanted, so biased, getting the facts wrong. There's truthsquad.com or .org in Michigan. You can go and see how slanted these ads are. They're doing a great job. If you can't listen to extended debates on WHFR or somewhere else, you probably don't know the facts about these candidates or the issues. I'm sorry to say that. So tune in next Friday, and we'll be back with you with more of the new WHFR Journal. It's now time for Highway 61 with Joanne Kay. Thank you for listening. This is WHFR Dearborn.